no spell or incantation is powerful enough to compel a demon lord to come when he is called. He will come only if he consents to come, usually for reasons of his own. Once I had learned all that the old wizard could teach me, I killed him. I journeyed south toward Kalida again. He sighed a bit regretfully. The old man was a kindly master. I was sorry that I had to kill him. Then he shrugged. But he was old, and I sent him off with a single knife stroke to the heart. "Steady, Darnak," Silk said, putting his hand on the angry smith's arm. "At Kalida, I found the temple in total disarray. My brothers had finally succumbed to absolute despair, and the temple had become a vile sink of corruption and degeneracy. I suppressed my outrage, however. I kept to myself. I dispatched word to Malyaska, advising Herakan that I had been successful in my mission, that I awaited his commands in the temple at Kalida. In time, I received a reply from one of the Kandom, who told me that Herakan had not yet returned from the west. Do you suppose that I could have a drink of water?" he asked. "I have a very foul taste in my mouth for some reason."
Sadi went to the water cask in the stern and dipped out a 10-cup of water.
"No drug is completely perfect," he murmured defensively to Geryon.
Arashak gratefully took the cup from Sadi and drank.
"Go on with your story,"
Belgarath told him. Arashak nodded.
"It was a bit less than a year ago that Herakan returned from the west. He came to Kalida, and he and I met in secret. I told him what I had accomplished and advised him of the limitations involved in any attempts to raise a demon lord. Then we went to a secluded place, and I instructed him in the incantations and spells which would raise an image of Nehaz and permit us to speak through the gate that lies between the worlds, communicating directly with Nehaz. Once I had established contact with the demon lord, Herakan began to speak with him. He mentioned Thragzadius, but Nehaz already knew of it. Then Herakan told Nehaz that during the long years that Torak slept, the disciple Irvan had become more and more obsessed with wealth and power, and had at last convinced himself that he was in fact a demigod, and but one step removed from divinity. Herakan proposed an alliance between himself and Nehaz. He suggested that the demon lord nudge Irvan over the edge into madness, and then aid him in defeating all of the others who were seeking the hiding place of Thragzadius. Unopposed, Irvan would easily gain the stone.
I gather that you chose to go along with them, instead of warning Irvan what was afoot. What did you get out of the arrangement?
They let me live. I think Herakan wanted to kill me just to be safe. But Nehaz told him that I could still be useful. He promised me kingdoms of my own to rule, and demon children to do my bidding. Herakan was won over by the demon lord, and he treated me courteously.
I don't exactly see that there's much advantage to Nehaz in giving the Tsardian to Irvan, Belgarath confessed.
Nehaz wants Thragzadius for himself. If Irvan has been driven mad, Nehaz will simply take Thragzadius from him and replace it with a piece of worthless rock. Then the demon lord and Herakan will put Irvan in a house somewhere. Ashaba, perhaps. Some other isolated castle. They'll surround him with imps and lesser demons to blind him with illusions. There he can play at being God in blissful ignorance and insanity, while Nahas and Hera can rule the world between them. Until the real new god of Angorak arises, Polgara added. There will be no new god of Angorak, Arshak disagreed. Once Nahas puts his hand on Thrag-Sardius, the Sardian, both prophecies will cease to exist. The child of light and child of dark will vanish forever. The elder gods will be banished, and Nahas will be lord of the universe, master of the destinies of all mankind.
And what does Herakan get out of this?
Dominion of the church, the secular throne of all the world.
I hope he got that in writing, Belgarath said dryly. Demons are notorious for not keeping their promises. Then what happened?
A messenger arrived at Kalida with instructions for Harkon from Irvan. The disciple told him that there must be a disruption in Karanda so violent that Khal Zakath would have no choice but to return from Tol Mergos. Once the Emperor was back in Meloria, it would be a simple matter to have him killed. And once he is dead, Irvan believes that he can manipulate the succession to place a tractable man on the throne, one he can take with him when he goes to the place where the Sardian lies hidden. Apparently, this is one of the conditions which must be met before the new god arises.
Belgarath nodded. A great many things are starting to fall into place. What happened then?
Herakan and I journeyed again in secret to the secluded place. They once again opened the gate and brought forth the image of Nahas. Herakan and the demon lord spoke together for a time. And suddenly the image was made flesh. Nahas himself stood before us. Herakan instructed me that I should henceforth call him by the name Manga, since the name Herakan is widely known in Meloria. And then we went again to Kalida, and Nahas went with us. The demon lord summoned his hordes, and Kalida fell. Nahas demanded a certain repayment for his aid, and Lord Minga instructed me to provide it. It was then that I discovered why Nahas had let me live. We spoke together, and he told me what he wanted. I didn't care for the notion, but the people involved were only Karans, so... He shrugged. The Karans regard Nahas as their god, and so it was not difficult for me to persuade young Karandese women that receiving the attentions of the demon lord would be a supreme honor. They went to him willingly, each one of them hoping in her heart to bear his offspring, not knowing, of course, that such a birth would rip them apart like a fresh-gutted pig. He smirked contemptuously. The rest, I think you know.
Oh, yes, we do indeed. Belgarath's voice was like a nail scraping across a flat stone. When did they leave? Herakan and Nahas, I mean. We know that they are no longer in this part of Karanda.
It was about a month ago. We were preparing to lay siege to Torpakan, on the border of Dalshin. I awoke one morning to discover that Lord Minga and the demon Nahas were gone, and that none of their familiar demons were any longer with the army. Everyone looked to me, but none of my spells or incantations could raise even the least of demons. The army grew enraged, and I barely escaped with my life. I journeyed north again toward Kalida, but found things there in total chaos. Without the demons to hold them in line, the Karans had quickly become unmanageable. I found that I could, however, still call up the image of Nahas. It seemed likely to me that with Menga and Nahas gone, I could sway Karandi's loyalty to me if I used the image cleverly enough, and thus come to rule all of Karanda myself. I was attempting a beginning of that plan this morning when you interrupted.
I see, Polgorath said bleakly.
How long have you been in this vicinity?
Polgora asked the captive suddenly.
Several weeks, the Grolem replied.
Good, she said. Some few weeks ago a woman came from the west carrying a child.
I pay little attention to women.
This one might have been a bit different. We know that she came to that village back on the lake shore, and that she would have hired a boat. Did any word of that reach you?
There are few travelers in Karanda right now. There's too much turmoil and upheaval. There's only one boat that left that village in the past month. I will tell you this. If the woman you seek was a friend of yours, and if she was on board that boat, prepare to mourn her.
Oh?
The boat sank in a sudden storm just off the city of Karand, on the east side of the lake in Ganesia.
Oh, the nice thing about Sandramas is her predictability, Silk murmured to Garion. I don't think we're going to have much trouble picking up her trail again, do you?
Arshag's eyelids were drooping now, and he seemed barely able to hold his head erect.
If you have any more questions for him, Ancient One, you should ask them quickly,
Sadi advised.
The drug is starting to wear off, and he is very close to sleep again.
I think I have all the answers I need, the old man replied.
And I have what I need as well, Polgora added grimly. Because of the size of the lake, there was no possibility of reaching the eastern shore before nightfall. So they lowered the sails and set a sea anchor to minimize the nighttime drift of their scow. They set sail again at first light, and shortly after noon saw a low, dark smudge along the eastern horizon.
That would be the east coast of the lake, Silk said to Garion. I'll go up to the bow and see if I can pick out some landmarks. I don't think we'll want to run right up to the wharves of Karand, do you?
No, not really.
I'll see if I can find us a quiet cove someplace, and then we can have a look around without attracting attention.
They beached the scow in a quiet bay surrounded by high sand dunes and scrubby brush about mid-afternoon.
What do you think, Grandfather?
Garion asked after they had unloaded the horses.
About what?
The boat. What should we do with it?
Set it adrift. Let's not announce that we came ashore here.
I suppose you're right, Garion sighed a bit regretfully. It wasn't a bad boat, though, was it?
It didn't tip over.
Capsize,
Garion corrected. Polgora came over to where they were standing.
Do you have any further need for Arshag? She asked the old man.
No, and I have been trying to decide what to do with him.
I'll take care of it, Father, she said.
She turned and went back to where Arshag lay still, once more bound and half asleep on the beach. She stood over him for a moment, then raised one hand. The Grolem flinched wildly, even as Garion felt the sudden powerful surge of her will.
Listen carefully, Arshag, she said. You provided the demon lord with women, so that he could unloose an abomination upon the world. That act must not go unrewarded. This, then, is your reward. You are now invincible. No one can kill you, no man, no demon, not even you yourself, but no one will ever again believe a single word that you say. You will be faced with constant ridicule and derision all the days of your life, and you will be driven wherever you go, wandering the world as a rootless vagabond. Thus are you repaid for aiding Menga, and helping him to unleash Nahaz, and for sacrificing foolish women to the demon lord's unspeakable lust.
She turned to Durnik.
"Untie him," she commanded. When his arms and legs were free, Arshag stumbled to his feet, his tattooed face ashen.
"Who are you, woman?" he demanded in a shaking voice. "And what power do you have to pronounce so terrible a curse?"
"I am Polgara," she replied. "You may have heard of me. Now, go." She pointed up the beach with an imperious finger. As if suddenly seized by an irresistible compulsion, Arshag turned, his face filled with horror. He stumbled up one of the sandy dunes and disappeared on the far side.
"Do you think it was wise to reveal your identity, my lady?"
Tadi asked dubiously. "There is no danger, Tadi. He can shout my name from every rooftop, but no one will believe him."
"How long will he live?"
Zenedra's voice was very small. "Indefinitely, I would imagine. Long enough, certainly, to give him time to appreciate fully the enormity of what it was that he did."
Zenedra stared at her.
"Lady Polgara,"
she said in a sick voice.
"How could you do it? It's horrible."
"Yes," Polgara replied. "It is. But so was what happened back at that temple we burned."
Chapter 23. The street, if it could be called that, was narrow and crooked. An attempt had been made at some time in the past to surface it with logs, but they had long since rotted and been trodden into the mud. Decaying garbage lay in heaps against the walls of crudely constructed log houses, and herds of scrawny pigs rooted dispiritedly through those heaps in search of food. As Silk and Geryon, once again wearing their Carandese vests and caps and their cross-tied sackcloth leggings, approached the docks jutting out into the lake, they were nearly overcome by the overpowering odor of long-dead fish.
"Fragrant sort of place, isn't it?" Silk noted, holding a handkerchief to his face.
"How can they stand it?"
Geryon asked, trying to keep from gagging.
"Their sense of smell has probably atrophied over the centuries," Silk replied. "The city of Karand is in the ancestral home of all of the Karands and all of the Seven Kingdoms. It has been here for aeons, so the debris and the smell has had a long time to build up."
A huge sow, trailed by a litter of squealing piglets, waddled out into the very center of the street and flopped over on her side with a loud grunt. The piglets immediately attacked, pushing and scrambling to nurse.
"In the Hanseth Hall?" Silk asked.
Geryon shook his head. The sword strapped across his back had neither twitched nor tugged, since the two of them had entered the city early that morning on foot by way of the north gate.
"Xander Amas might not have even entered the city at all. She has avoided populated places before, you know."
"Oh, that's true, I suppose," Silk admitted. "But I don't think we should go any farther until we locate the place where she landed. She could have gone in any direction once she got to this side of the lake. Darshiva, Zamad, Varisebo, even down into Delshin, and then on down the Megan, into the Wrangel or Beldane."
"I know," Geryon said. "But all of this delay is very frustrating. We're getting closer to her, I can just feel it. And every minute we waste gives her that much more time to escape again with Geryon."
"It can't be helped," Silk shrugged. "About all we can do here is follow the inside of the wall and walk along the waterfront. If she came through the city at all, we are certain to cross her path."
They turned a corner and looked down another muddy street toward the lake shore, where fishnets hung over large poles. They slogged through the mud until they reached the street that ran along the shoreline, where floating docks reached out into the lake, and then followed it along the waterfront. There was a certain amount of activity here. A number of sailors, dressed in faded blue tunics,
were hauling a large boat half full of water up onto the shore with a great deal of shouting and contradictory words. Here and there on the docks, a group of fishermen in rusty brown sat mending their nets, and farther along the street several loiterers in fur vests and leggings sat on the long stoop in front of a sour-smelling tavern, drinking from cheap tin cups. A blowsy young woman with frizzy orange hair and a pockmarked face leaned out of the second-story window, calling to passers-by in a voice she tried to make seductive, but which Garrigan found to be merely coarse.
"Busy place," Silk murmured.
Garrigan grunted, and they moved on along the littered street. Coming from the other direction, they saw a group of armed men. Though they all wore helmets of one kind or another, the rest of their clothing was mismatched colors and could by no stretch of the imagination be called uniforms. Their self-important swagger, however, clearly indicated that they were either soldiers or some kind of police.
"You two, halt!"
one of them barked as they came abreast of Garrigan and Silk.
"Is there some problem, sir?" Silk asked ingratiatingly.
"I have not seen you here before,"
the man said, his hand on his sword hilt.
He was a tall fellow, with lank red hair poking out from under his helmet.
"Identify yourselves."
"My name is Saldus," Silk lied. "This is Kvasta," he pointed at Garrigan. "We are strangers here in Grand."
"What is your business here? And where do you come from?"
"We are from Dorakan, in Geno," Silk told him. "And we are here looking for my older brother. He sailed out from the village of Tashun on the other side of the lake a while back and has not returned." The red-headed man looked suspicious. "We talked with a fellow near the north gate," Silk continued, "and he told us that there was a boat that sank. They went down in a storm just off the docks here." His face took on a melancholy expression. "The time would have been just about right, I think, and the description he gave us of the boat matched the one my brother was sailing. Have you by any chance heard about it, sir?" The little man sounded very sincere. Some of the suspicion faded from the red-haired man's face.
"It seems to me that I heard some mention of it," he conceded.
"The fellow we talked with said that he thought there might have been some survivors. One that he knew of, anyway. He said that a woman, in a dark cloak and carrying a baby, managed to get away in a small boat. Do you, by any chance, happen to know anything about that?" The Karan's face hardened.
Yes. We know about her, all right."
"Could you, by any chance, tell me where she went? I would really like to talk with her and find out if she knows anything about my brother." He leaned toward the other man confidentially. "To be perfectly honest with you, good sir, I can't stand my brother. We have hated each other since we were children. But I promised my old father that I would find out what happened to him." And then he winked outrageously. "There's an inheritance involved, you understand. If I can take definite word back to father that my brother is dead, I stand to come into a nice piece of property." The red-haired man grinned.
"I can understand your situation, Saldus. I had a dispute with my own brothers about our patrimony."
His eyes narrowed.
"You say you are from Dorakan?"
"Oh, yes, on the banks of the northern river Magan. Do you know our city?"
"Does Dorakan follow the teachings of Lord Menga?"
"The Liberator? Of course. Doesn't all of Karanda?"
"Have you seen any of the Dark Lords in the last month or so?"
"The minions of the Lord Nahaz? No, I can't say that I have. But then, Kvasta and I haven't attended any worship services for some time.
I am sure that the wizards are still raising them, though.
I wouldn't be all that sure, Saldas. We haven't seen one here in Karand for over 5 weeks. Our wizards have tried to summon them, but they refuse to come. Even the Grolems who now worship Lord Nahaz have not been successful. And they are all powerful magicians, you know.
Truly, Silk agreed.
Have you heard anything at all about Lord Minga's whereabouts?
Silk shrugged. The last I heard, he was in Katakor someplace. In Dorakan we are just waiting for his return, so that we can sweep the Angoraks out of Olcaranda. The answer seemed to satisfy the tall fellow.
All right, Saldas. I would say that you've got a legitimate reason to be in Karand after all. I don't think you're going to have much luck in finding the woman you want to talk to, though. From what I've heard, she was on your brother's boat, and she did get away before the storm hit. She had a small boat, and she landed to the south of the city. She came to the south gate with her brat in her arms and went straight to the temple. She talked with the Grolems inside for about an hour. When she left, they were all following her.
Which way did they go?
Out the east gate.
And how long ago was it?
Late last week. I'll tell you something, Saldas. Lord Minga had better stop whatever he's doing in Karakor and come back to Central Karanda where he belongs. The whole movement is starting to falter. The Dark Lords have deserted us, and the Grolems are trailing after this woman with the baby. All we have left are the wizards, and they're mostly mad, anyway. Now, they've always been, haven't they?
Silk grinned. Tampering with the supernatural tends to unsettle men's brains, so I've noticed.
You seem like a sensible man, Saldas,
the redhead said, clapping him on the shoulder.
I'd like to stay and talk with you further. But my men and I have to finish our patrol. I hope you find your brother,
he winked slyly.
Or don't find him, I should say.
Silk grinned back. I thank you for your wishes. About my brother's growing ill health, he replied. The soldiers moved off along the street.
You tell better stories than Belgarath does, Geryon said to his little friend.
Oh, it's a gift. That was a very profitable encounter, wasn't it? Now I understand why the orb has not picked up the trail yet. We came into the city by the way of the north gate, and Xandarmas came up from the south. If we go straight to the temple, the orb is likely to jerk you off your feet.
Geryon nodded. The important thing is, we're only a few days behind her.
He paused, frowning.
Why is she gathering Grolems, though?
Who knows? Reinforcements, maybe. She knows that we are right behind her. Or maybe she thinks she's going to need Grolems, who have training in Kerendi's magic when she gets home to Darshiva. If Nahaz has sent his demons down there, she is going to need all the help she can get. We'll let Belgarath sort that out. Let's go to the temple, see if we can pick up the trail. As they approached the temple in the center of the city, the orb began to pull at Geryon again, and he felt a surge of exultation.
I've got it, he said to Silk.
Good, the little man looked up at the temple. I see that they have made some modifications. The polished steel mask of the face of Torak, which normally occupied the place directly over the nail-studded door, had been removed. In its place was a red-painted skull with a pair of horns screwed down onto its brow. I don't know that the skull is all that big of an improvement. But then it's no great change for the worse, either. I was getting a little tired of that mask staring at me every time I turned around.
Let's follow the trail, Geryon suggested. We'll make certain that Xandarmas left the city before we go get the others.
Right, Silk agreed. The trail led from the door of the temple through the littered streets to the east gate of the city, Geryon and Silk followed it out of Karand, and perhaps a half mile along the highway leading eastward across the plains of Genesia.
"Is she veering at all?" Silk asked.
"No, not yet. She's following the road."
"Good. Let's go get the others, and our horses. We won't make very good time on foot."
They moved away from the road, walking through knee-high grass.
"Looks like good fertile soil here," Geryon noted. "Have you and Yarblek ever considered buying farmland? It might be a good investment."
"No, Geryon," Silk laughed. "There's a major drawback to owning land. If you have to leave a place in a hurry, there is no way that you can pick it up and carry it along with you."
"Well, that's true, I guess."
The others waited in a grove of large old willows, a mile or so north of the city, and their faces were expectant as Geryon and Silk ducked in under the branches.
"Did you find it?" Belgareth asked.
Geryon nodded. "She went east."
"And apparently she took all of the Grolems from the temple along with her," Silk added.
Belgareth looked puzzled.
"Why would she do that?"
"I haven't got a clue. I suppose we could ask her when we catch up with her."
"Could you get any idea of how far ahead of us she is?"
Zenithra asked.
"Just a few days," Geryon said. "With any luck, we'll catch her before she gets across the mountains of Zamad."
"Not if we don't get started," Belgareth said.
They rode on back across the wide open field to the highway, leading across the plains toward the upthrusting peaks lying to the east. The orb picked up the trail again, and they followed it at a canter.
"What kind of city was it?"
Velvet asked Silk as they rode along.
"Nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. The pigs are clean enough, but the people are awfully dirty."
"Cleverly put, Keldar."
"I've always had a way with words," he conceded modestly.
"Father," Bulgara called to the old man, "a large number of Grolems have passed this way." He looked around and nodded.
"Silk was right, then. For some reason, she is subverting Minga's people. Let's be alert for any possible ambushes."
They rode on for the rest of the day and camped that night some distance away from the road, starting out again at first light in the morning. About midday, they saw a roadside village some distance ahead. Coming from that direction was a solitary man in a rickety cart being pulled by a bony white horse.
"Do you by any chance have a flagon of ale, Lady Polgara?" Sadi asked as they slowed to a walk.
"Are you thirsty?"
"Oh, it's not for me. I detest ale personally. It's for that carter just ahead. I thought we might want some information."
He looked over at Silk.
"Are you feeling at all sociable today, Keldar?"
"No more than usual. Why?"
"Take a drink or two of this," the eunuch said, offering the little man the flagon Polgara had taken from one of the packs. "Not too much, mind. I only want you to smell drunk."
"Why not?" Silk shrugged, taking a long drink.
"That should do it," Zadi approved. "Now, give it back."
"I thought you didn't want any."
"I don't. I'm just going to add a bit of flavoring."
He opened his red case.
"Don't drink any more from this flagon," he warned Silk, as he tapped four drops of a gleaming red liquid into the mouth of the flagon. "If you do, we will all have to listen to you talk for days on end."
He handed the flagon back to the little man.
"Why don't you go offer that poor fellow up there a drink?" he suggested. "He looks like he could use one."
"You didn't poison it, did you?"
"Of course not. It's very hard to get information out of somebody who is squirming on the ground clutching at his belly. One or two good drinks from that flagon, though, and the carter will be seized by an uncontrollable urge to talk. About anything at all, and to anybody who asks him a question in a friendly fashion. Go be
friendly to the poor man, Kaldar. He looks dreadfully lonesome. Silk grinned, then turned and trotted his horse toward the oncoming cart, swaying in his saddle and singing loudly, and very much off-key.
"He's very good," Velvet murmured to Zenedra. "But he always overacts his part. When we get back to Boktor, I think I will send him to a good drama coach."
Zenedra laughed. By the time they reached the cart, the seedy-looking man in a rust-red smock had pulled his vehicle off to the side of the road, and he and Silk had joined in a song, a rather bawdy one.
"Ha ha! There you are," Silk said, squinting owlishly at Zadi. "I wondered how long it was going to take you to catch up. Here," he thrust the flagon at the eunuch, "have a drink."
Zadi feigned taking a long drink from the flagon. Then he sighed lustily, wiped his mouth on his sleeve, and handed the flagon back. Silk passed it to the carter.
"Your turn, friend."
The carter took a drink and then grinned foolishly.
"I haven't felt this good in weeks," he said.
"We are riding toward the east," Zadi told him.
"I saw that right off," the carter said. "That's unless you've taught your horses to run backward."
He laughed uproariously at that, slapping his knee in glee.
"How droll," the eunuch murmured. "Do you come from that village just up ahead?"
"Lived there all my life," the carter replied. "And my father before me, and his father before him, and his father's father before that, and—"
"Have you seen a dark-cloaked woman with a babe in her arms go past here within the last week?"
Zadi interjected.
"She probably would have been in the company of a fairly large party of Grolems."
The carter made the sign to ward off the evil eye at the mention of the word Grolem.
"Oh, yes. She came by all right. She went into the local temple here, if you can really call it a temple. It's no bigger than my own house, and it's only got 3 Grolems in it, 2 young ones and an old one. Anyway, this woman with the babe in her arms, she goes into the temple and we can hear her talking. Pretty soon she comes out with our 3 Grolems. Only the old one was trying to talk the 2 young ones into staying. Then she says something to the young ones, and they pull out their knives and start stabbing the old one. He yells and falls down on the ground dead as a mutton. And the woman takes our 2 young Grolems back to the road. They join in with the others and they all go off, leaving us only that old dead one lying on his face in the mud and—"
"How many Grolems would you say she had with her?"
"Counting our 2? I'd say maybe 30 or 40. Could be as many as 50. I've never been very good at quick guesses like that. I can tell the difference between 3 and 4, but after that I get confused and—"
"Could you give us any idea of exactly how long ago all that was?"
Let's see."
The carter squinted at the sky, counting on his fingers.
"It couldn't have been yesterday, because yesterday I took that load of barrels over to Toadface's farm. Do you know Toadface?" "Ugliest man I ever saw. Oh, but his daughter's a real beauty. I could tell you stories about her, let me tell you."
"So it wasn't yesterday?"
"No, definitely wasn't yesterday. I spent most of yesterday under a haystack with Toadface's daughter. And I know it wasn't the day before, because I got drunk that day. Don't remember a thing that happened after mid-morning."
He took another drink from the flagon.
"How about the day before that?"
Could have been. Or the day before that.
Or even before?"
The carter shook his head.
"No, that was the day our pig farrowed, and I know that the woman came by after that. Had to have been the day before the
day before yesterday or the day before that.
3 or 4 days ago, then?
If that's the way it works out, the carter shrugged, drinking again.
Thanks for the information, friend, Zadi said. He looked at Silk. We should be moving on, I suppose.
Did you want your jar back?
The carter asked.
Go ahead.
Keep it, friend, Silk said. I think I've had enough anyway.
Thanks for the ale and the talk, the carter called as they rode away.
Geryon glanced back and saw that the fellow had climbed down from his cart and was engaging in an animated conversation with his horse.
3 days?
Zinedra exclaimed happily.
Or at the most, 4, Zadi said.
We are gaining on her,
Zinedra said, suddenly leaning over and throwing her arms about the eunuch's neck.
So it appears, Your Majesty,
Zadi agreed, looking slightly embarrassed. They camped off the road again that night, and started out again early the following morning. The sun was just coming up when the large blue-banded hawk came spiraling in. It flared its wings and shimmered into the form of Belden at the instant its talons touched the road.
"You've got company waiting for you just ahead," he told them, pointing at the first line of foothills of the mountains of Zamad, lying perhaps a mile in front of them.
"Oh?" Belgareth said, reining in his horse.
"About 12 Grolems. They're hiding in the bushes on either side of the road,"
Belgareth swore.
"Have you been doing things to annoy the Grolems?" the hunchback asked.
Belgareth shook his head. "Zandramos has been gathering them as she goes along. She's got quite a few of them with her now. She probably left that group behind to head off pursuit. She knows that we are right behind her."
"What are we going to do, Belgareth?"
Zinedra asked.
"We are so close. We can't stop now."
The old man looked at his brother sorcerer.
"Well?" Belden scowled at him. "All right, I'll do it. But don't forget that you owe me, Belgareth."
"Write it down with all of the other things. We will settle up when this is all over."
"Don't think I won't."
"Did you find out where Nahaz took Irvon?"
"Would you believe they went back to Malyaska?"
Belden sounded disgusted. "They will come out eventually," Belgareth assured him. "Are you going to need any help with the Grolems? I could send Paul along if you like."
"Are you trying to be funny?"
"No, I was just asking. Don't make too much noise."
Belden made a vulgar sound, changed again, and swooped away.
"Where's he going?" Silk asked.
"He is going to draw off the Grolems."
"Oh? How?"
"I didn't ask him," Belgareth shrugged. "We will give him a little while, and then we should be able to ride straight on through."
"Oh, he's very good, isn't he?"
"Belden? Oh, yes. Very, very good. There he goes now."
Silk looked around.
"Where?"
"I didn't see him. I heard him. He's flying low a mile or so to the north of where the Grolems are hiding, and he is kicking up just enough noise to make it sound as if the whole group of us are trying to slip around them without being seen."
He glanced at his daughter. "Paul, would you take a look and see if it's working?"
"All right, father."
She concentrated, and Geryon could feel her mind reaching out, probing.
"They've taken the bait. They all ran off after Belden."
"Oh, that was accommodating of them, wasn't it? Let's move on."
They pushed their horses into a gallop and covered the distance to the first foothills of the mountains of Zamad in a short period of time. They followed the road up a steep slope and through a shallow notch. Beyond that, the terrain grew more rugged, and the dark green forest rose steeply up the flanks of the peaks. Geryon began to sense conflicting signals from the orb as he rode. At first, he had only felt its eagerness to follow the trail of Zandramas and Geryon. But now he began to feel a sullen undertone, a sound of ageless, implacable hatred,
and at his back where the sword was sheathed, he began to feel an increasing heat.
"Why is it burning red?"
Zinedra asked from behind him. "What's burning red?"
"The orb, I think. I can see it glowing right through the leather covering you have over it."
"Let's stop a while," Belgarath told them, reining in his horse.
"What is it, grandfather?"
"I am not sure. Take the sword out and slip off the sleeve. Let's see what's happening." Geryon drew the sword from its sheath. It seemed heavier than usual, for some reason. And when he peeled off the soft leather covering, they were all able to see that instead of its usual azure blue, the orb of Alder was glowing a dark, sooty red.
"What is it, father?"
Polgara asked.
"It feels the Sardian,"
Erion said in a calm voice.
"Are we that close?"
Geryon demanded.
"Is this the place which is no more?" "I don't think so, Belgarion," the young man replied. "It's something else." "Well, what is it, then?" "I'm not sure. But the orb is responding to the other stone. They talk to each other in a fashion that I don't understand."
They rode on, and some time later, the blue-banded hawk came swirling in, blurred into Belden's shape, and stood in front of them. The gnarled dwarf had a slightly self-satisfied look on his face. "You look like a cat that just got into the cream," Belgarath said.
"Naturally. I just sent a dozen or so Grolems off in the general direction of the polar ice cap. They'll have a wonderful time when the pan ice starts to break up and they get to float around up there for the rest of the summer."
"Are you going to scout on ahead?" Belgarath asked him.
"Well, I suppose so," Belden replied.
He held out his arms, blurred into feathers, and drove himself into the air. They rode more cautiously now, climbing deeper and deeper into the mountains of Zamad. The surrounding country grew more broken. The reddish-hued peaks were jagged, and their lower flanks were covered with dark fir and pine. Rushing streams boiled over the rocks and dropped in frothy waterfalls over steep cliffs. The road, which had been straight and flat on the plains of Ganesia, began to twist and turn as it crawled up the steep slopes. It was nearly noon when Belden returned again.
"The main party of Grolems turned south. There are about 40 of them."
"Was Zandramas with them?"
Geryon asked quickly.
"No, I don't think so. At least I didn't pick up the sense of anyone unusual in the group."
"We haven't lost her, have we?"
Zinedra asked in alarm.
"No," Geryon replied. "The orb still has her trail."
He glanced over his shoulder. The stone on the hilt of his sword was still burning a sullen red. "About all we can do is follow her," Belgarath said. "It is Zandramas we are interested in, not a party of stray Grolems. Can you pinpoint exactly where we are?" he asked Belden.
"Meloria."
"Oh, very funny.
We've crossed into Zamad. This road goes on down into Vorisabo, though. Where's my mule?"
"Back with the pack horses," Durnig told him. As they moved on, Geryon could feel Polgara probing on ahead with her mind. "Are you getting anything, Paul?" Belgarath asked her.
"Oh, nothing specific, father. I can sense the fact that Zandramas is close. But she is shielding, so I cannot pinpoint her."
They rode on, moving at a cautious walk now. Then, as the road passed through a narrow gap and descended on the far side, they saw a figure in a gleaming white robe standing at the side of the road. As they drew closer, Geryon saw that it was Tsaradas.
"Move with great care in this place," she cautioned,
and there was a note of anger in her voice.
"The Child of Dark seeks to circumvent the ordered course of events, and hath laid a trap for ye."
"There's nothing new or surprising about that," Belden growled. "What does she hope to accomplish?"
"It is her thought to slay one of the companions of the Child of Light, and thereby prevent the completion of one of the tasks, which must be accomplished ere the final meeting. Should she succeed,
all that hath gone before shall come to naught. Follow me, and I will guide you safely to the next task."
Toth stepped down from his horse and quickly led it to the side of his slender mistress. She smiled at him, her face radiant, and laid a slim hand on his huge arm. With no apparent effort, the huge man lifted her into the saddle of his horse, and then took the reins in his hands.
"Aunt Paul,"
Geryon whispered,
"is it my imagination, or is she really there this time?"
Polgara looked intently at the blindfolded seeress.
"It's not a projection. It's much more substantial. I could not begin to guess how she got here, but I think you're right, Geryon. She is really here."
They followed the seeress and her mute guide down the steeply descending road into a grassy basin, surrounded on all sides by towering firs. In the center of the basin was a small mountain lake sparkling in the sunlight. Polgara suddenly drew in her breath sharply.
"We are being watched."
"Who is it, Paul?"
"The mind is hidden, Father. All I can get is the sense of watching and anger."
A smile touched her lips.
"I'm sure it's Sandramos. She is shielding, so I cannot reach her mind. But she cannot shield out my sense of being watched, and she cannot control her anger enough to keep me from picking up the edges of it."
"Well, who is she so angry with?"
"Serratus, I think. She went to a great deal of trouble to lay a trap for us, and Serratus came along and spoiled it. She still might try something. So I think we had all better be on our guard."
He nodded bleakly.
"Right," he agreed.
Toth led the horse his mistress was riding out into the basin and stopped at the edge of the lake. When the rest of them reached her, she pointed down through the crystal water.
"The task lies there. Below lies a submerged grot. One of you must enter that grot and then return. Much shall be revealed there."
Belgorath looked hopefully at Belden.
"Not this time, old man," the dwarf said, shaking his head. "I am a hawk, not a fish, and I don't like cold water any more than you do."
"Paul?" Belgorath said rather plaintively.
"I don't think so, Father. I think it is your turn this time. Besides, I need to concentrate on Sandramos."
He bent over and dipped his hand into the sparkling water, and then he shuddered.
"This is cruel," he said.
Silk was grinning at him.
"Don't say it, Prince Keldar,"
Belgorath scowled, starting to remove his clothing.
"Just keep your mouth shut."
They were perhaps all a bit surprised at how sleekly muscular the old man was. Despite his fondness for rich food and good brown ale, his stomach was as flat as a board. Although he was as lean as a rail, his shoulders and chest rippled when he moved.
"My, my,"
Velvet murmured appreciatively, eyeing the loincloth-clad old man. He suddenly grinned at her impishly.
"Would you care for another frolic in a pool, Lizelle?"
he invited with a wicked look in his bright blue eyes. She suddenly blushed a rosy red, glancing guiltily at Silk. Belgorath laughed, arched himself forward, and split the water of the lake as cleanly as the blade of a knife. Several yards out he broached, leaping high into the air with the sun gleaming on his silvery scales and his broad forked tail flapping and shaking droplets. They looked like jewels across the sparkling surface of the lake. Then his dark, heavy body drove down, and down into the depths of the crystal lake he went.
"Oh, my," Durnick breathed, his hands twitching.
"Never mind, dear," Polgara laughed. "He wouldn't like it at all if you stuck a fishhook in his jaw."
The great silver-sided salmon swirled down and disappeared into an irregularly shaped opening near the bottom of the lake. They waited, and Geryon found himself unconsciously holding his breath. After what seemed an eternity, the great fish shot from the mouth of the submerged cave, drove himself far out into the lake, and then returned,
skipping across the surface of the water on his tail, shaking his head and almost seeming to balance himself with his fins. Then he plunged forward into the water near the shore, and Belgarath emerged, dripping and shivering.
"Invigorating," he observed, climbing back up onto the bank. "Have you got a blanket handy, Paul?" he asked, stripping the water from his arms and legs with his hands.
"Show off," Belden grunted.
"What was down there?" Geryon asked.
"It looks like an old temple of some kind," the old man answered, vigorously drying himself with the blanket Polgara had handed to him. "Somebody took a natural cave and walled up the sides, giving it some kind of shape. There was an altar there, with a special kind of niche in it, empty naturally, but the place was filled with an overpowering presence, and all the rocks glowed red."
"The Sardian?" Belden demanded intently.
"Not anymore," Belgarath replied, drying his hair. "It was there, though, for a long, long time, and it had built a barrier of some kind to keep anybody from finding it. It's gone now, but I will recognize the signs of it the next time I get close."
"Geryon," Tynedra cried, "look!"
With a trembling hand, she was pointing at a nearby crag. High atop that rocky promontory stood a figure wrapped in shiny black satin. Even before the figure tossed back its hood with a gesture of supreme arrogance, he knew who it was. Without thinking, he reached for Iron Grip's sword, his mind suddenly aflame. But then Serathus spoke in a clear, firm voice.
"I am wroth with thee, Zandramos," she declared. "Seek not to interfere with that which must come to pass, lest I make my choice here and now."
"And if thou dost, sightless creeping worm, then all will turn to chaos, and thy task will be incomplete, and blind chance will supplant prophecy. Behold, I am the child of dark, and I fear not the hand of chance, for chance is my servant, even more than it is the servant of the child of light."
And then Geryon heard a low snarl, a dreadful sound, more dreadful yet because it came from his wife's throat. Moving faster than he thought was possible, Tynedra dashed to Durnik's horse and ripped the smith's axe from the rope sling which held it. With a scream of rage, she ran around the edge of the tiny mountain lake brandishing that axe.
"Tynedra!"
he shouted, lunging after her.
"No!"
Zandramos laughed with a cruel laugh of glee.
"Choose, Serathus. Make thine empty choice, for in the death of the Riven Queen I triumph!"
And she raised both hands over her head. Though he was running as fast as he could, Geryon saw that he had no hope of catching Tynedra before she moved fatally close to the satin-robed sorceress atop the crag. Even now his wife had begun scrambling up the rocks, screeching curses and hacking at the boulders that got in her way with Durnik's axe. Then, the form of a glowing blue wolf suddenly appeared between Tynedra and the object of her fury. Tynedra stopped as if frozen, and Zandramos recoiled from the snarling wolf. The light around the wolf flickered briefly, and there, still standing between Tynedra and Zandramos, stood the form of Geryon's ultimate grandmother, Belgarath's wife and Polgara's mother. Her tawny hair was aflame with blue light, and her golden eyes blazed with an unearthly fire.
"You!"
Zandramos gasped, shrinking back even further. Poledra reached back, took Tynedra to her side, and protectively put one arm about her tiny shoulders. With her other hand, she gently removed the axe from the little queen's suddenly nerveless fingers. Tynedra's eyes were wide and unseeing, and she stood immobilized, as if in a trance.
"She is under my protection, Zandramos," Poledra said, "and you may not harm her."
The sorceress atop the crag howled in sudden, frustrated rage. Her eyes ablaze, she once again drew herself erect.
"Will it be now, Zandramos?"
Poledra asked in a deadly voice.
"Is this the time you have chosen for our meeting? You know,
even as I, that should we meet at the wrong time and in the wrong place, we will both be destroyed.
I do not fear thee, Poledra,
the sorceress shrieked.
Nor I you. Come then, Zandramas, let us destroy each other here and now. For should the Child of Light go on to the place which is no more unopposed, and find no Child of Dark awaiting him there, then I triumph. If this be the time and place of your choosing, bring forth your power and let it happen, for I grow weary of you.
The face of Zandramas was twisted with rage. Geryon could feel the force of her will building up. He tried to reach over his shoulder for his sword, thinking to unleash its fire and blast the hated sorceress from atop her crag. But even as Zenedra's apparently were, he found that his muscles were all locked in stasis. From behind him, he could feel the others also struggling to shake free of the force which seemed to hold them in place.
No, Poledra's voice sounded firmly in the vaults of his mind. This is between Zandramas and me. Don't interfere.
Well, Zandramas, she said aloud then,
what is your decision? Will you cling to life a while longer, or will you die now?
The sorceress struggled to regain her composure, even as the glowing nimbus about Poledra grew more intense. Then Zandramas howled with enraged disappointment and disappeared in a flash of orange fire.
I thought she might see it my way, Poledra said calmly.
She turned to face Geryon and the others. There was a twinkle in her golden eyes.
What took you all so long? I've been waiting for you here for months.
She looked rather critically at the half-naked Belgorath, who was staring at her with a look of undisguised adoration.
You're as thin as a bone, old wolf, she told him. You really ought to eat more, you know.
She smiled fondly at him.
Would you like to have me go catch you a nice fat rabbit?
Then she laughed, shimmered back into the form of the blue wolf and loped away, her paws seeming scarcely to touch the earth. Here ends Book 3 of the Malorian. Book 4, Sorceress of Darshiva, continues the search for Zandramas and for the Sardian, which has been at many sites, but is now to be found at the place which is no more. Whatever that means. You've been listening to Demon Lord of Caranda by David Eddings. This book is a work of fiction. Any resemblance to any persons living or dead is entirely coincidental. For the studios of Books in Motion, I'm Cameron Byerly, thanking you for listening.